podcast contains strong language and adult themes from the outset.
Hello everyone, and thanks for listening to Because You Watched, the podcast where comedians get together to come up with brand new TV show and movie ideas. Producer Rory here, standing in for Beck Hill, just to let you know we're away for a bit now, but we didn't want to leave your podcatcher all hungry. So we've put together this very special episode featuring some of our favourite ideas from the last series. This episode contains completely new and original TV show and movie pitches from Michael Legg, Lou Sanders, Laurel X, Matt Hyten, Jessica Fostercue, and Egg, aka Emily Lloyd Sayani and Anna Long Brophy, as well as featuring our series regulars Georgia Maguire, John Gracie, and Paul Foxcroft, plus me and Beck too. So settle in, kick back, turn up the volume to a level that's loud enough for you to hear it, but not so loud that it disturbs everyone around you, and get ready for some unadulterated TV and movie gold. Then, once you've realised that that's not going to happen, try listening to this instead. First up, we have Michael Legg's pitch for a post-apocalypse TV show.
Michael, what do you have for us?
It's a TV show that I'm pitching right now. It definitely falls into... can I give you the exact genre?
Oh, please.
Yes, please do.
It's sort of a post-apocalyptic, sci-fi, horror, romantic drama talent contest.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, specific. I like it.
Yeah, that's what I've gone for. Let me talk you through. The world is run by the money men. Oh. The bookies. Yeah. The bookies now live in luxury while the poor dream of getting out of their hellhole lives by raising enough money to gamble and free themselves from their poverty by singing country music standards and being judged by the public each week. Now, this is all happening after a global outbreak of COVID-73.
I should say that this
is actually set in 2173. Now, minions are living half lives, walking like the undead and feeding on human hair. It's just how the virus spreads, okay? If you get your hair bitten, you have between 3 days and 85 years to live.
Oh, no.
Now, here's where we get to the main story. Buck Butter is a man with three lives. He's an ex-gambler, an ex-country music manager and mogul, and now a single parent with a child who got their hair bitten.
Oh, no.
Buck has no choice. If he wants to buy medicine to protect his daughter, he has to take what little money he has to the only city left on Earth, Durham, and gamble. Yeah, he has to gamble for the first time in 40 years. It'll be a walk lasting months, but he has to do it and bring his daughter and any lost souls he meets along the way with him. That's my pitch.
Now we've got the full context. What is the title of that bad boy?
Yeah.
It's a road story. It's based on the fact that betting can save your lives. The title is Gamble Ramble.
Very nice. Very nice.
I like it.
Yeah, pretty happy with it.
You know that appeals to me. I love wordplay. And what are people betting on in this sort of future?
Well, this is it. I'm hoping that the viewer in the first episode or two going, oh, I see what's happening. People bet on horses and then they win money. But of course, the evil corporation is keeping, is fixing a lot of the reg. That's what I'm hoping. But as maybe the series goes on, we find it's not actually horses. Maybe it's people in horse suits. You know, maybe there hasn't been a horse on Earth in like 100 years.
Well, you see, well that perfectly works. Mm. Yeah, because then they can rig the matches because they're not even real horses, and that's why they're so rich.
Yeah, it's exactly Exactly. It's. Yeah. I mean, if that does not reflect exactly what's happening today, then I don't know what does.
So what was your name? Your main character's name again?
Butter.
Butter is in the piece of food.
Yeah, it's in the spreadable. So, yeah.
Buck Butter is kind of like your, if you know, if this show, I guess you would say, is what sort of similar to The Walking Dead.
Yeah, very, very. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that people that if they miss one or two series, they'll know when they do watch an episode, they've missed nothing.
Yeah, it's a good way to make it.
Yeah, it's Walking Dead meets like Ocean's 11, but they've not been formally introduced, so they're sitting awkwardly together.
Right, this is good. This is good. And our pilot episode, what are we see? How are you setting up the pilot episode?
Oh, well, the pilot episode has to be, we have to see how post-apocalyptic this world is, I think. I think we have to see how rich the bloody money corporate men are, the bookies. And we have to see how really regretful Buck Butter is of his previous lives, both in the gambling and music businesses.
Well, also most of these, you talk about the big corporations and stuff. Feels like there needs to be a big bad, like a main baddie who sort of represents these corporations.
I've got some main characters, if you'd like me to talk you through.
Oh, yes, please,
characters. No, I want additional, like The Walking Dead, I want additional characters to come and go, because I do want people, every week I do want someone to sing a country and western song and the public to judge whether or not they were good enough to be in the next episode of Gamble Ramble. Let's start with Buck.
Sorry, I've just realised that would mean this has a 1 week rolling production time.
Exactly. Yeah. To be really honest, in a post-apocalyptic world, you don't have a lot of time if you want to survive. And I think the production really has to reflect that.
That's fair.
So let's go through the characters. Buck Butter. I see a lot of myself in Buck Butter. He's in his 60s, quiet, but full of bitter rage. Dead wife, alive daughter. That's that man.
Yeah.
I've come up with another character who he meets along the way. Her name's Gwyneth. Now, Gwyneth is really interesting. Gwyneth is very interesting. She dreamt that Wayne Karate, head of Hyperglobal Ladbrokes Corporation, she dreamt that he killed her sick daddy. And now she has left her daddy at home alone to go to Durham to seek revenge.
Nice.
Right. Wait, she's left her alive dad at home to seek revenge for his death sick that she imagined.
Yeah. But you know how it feels. When you wake up, it feels very real.
If that's how you feel, no one can make you change your mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I've already mentioned Wayne Karate. Let's have a look at this guy. Wayne Karate, he is a dick. He's money obsessed. He uses orphans as toilet paper. He controls... Right? He sounds awful, doesn't he?
What an absolute rotter.
His toilet must be huge.
Really, really, and smelly, because, like, orphans.
Imagine the plumbing needed to flush orphans. Oh, my God.
Right.
Do you know what? They probably think it's like a water slide. What it is, it's just a man wiping their bottom on them, but then they go down a water slide, which I could think of worse fates.
Yeah, the thing is, there's such a lack of water in this post-apocalyptic world that the orphans are sort of pushed down the toilet to clean it on the way.
Like Victorian chimney sweeps.
Yeah, orphans are water in this post-apocalyptic future. So, anyway.
So one point you have a... Sorry, just have a glug, glug. Ah, refreshing orphan.
I was an orphan, yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
We are 70% water, so the story checks out.
Yeah, you just... If you really force a straw into an orphan, you'll get a pretty good drink out of it. Now,
like a sort of writhing Capri Sun.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a Capri Sun, but with an S-O-N.
Yeah.
So he's obsessed with money. Now he controls everything, but is often undermined by the cryogenic brain of kindly old Jeremiah Ladbrokes, who opened Ladbrokes back in 1965. As a children's hospital.
Oh.
You can see they're not going to get on.
Mainly because he keeps drinking the patients.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big no-no as far as kindly old brain in a jar Jeremiah.
So I'm assuming to make sure that no one votes off the the lead villains or anything, that Wayne Coratti is going to be an absolutely exceptional country singer.
Oh, I mean, he's going to sing like the Man in Black himself. He's going to... you will hate that guy, but that voice...
Will Smith.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You can't deny it. You can't deny that.
He'll be rapping... Awesome. I mean, the worst rapper in the world can be doing all of that, but we'll love him for it.
Also, at the end of every episode, are the end credits wrapped over like the end of a Will Smith film?
Yeah, it's exactly that.
Great.
Yeah, it's a country music show, but I absolutely insist on Public Enemy doing the theme tune. I insist on it.
Nice.
Fantastic. So you've got Public Enemy in there now. Who do you see playing these characters then? Who would be Buck Butters?
Right. Well, I've done some initial casting. I'm sort of seeing Buck Butter, sort of like Billy Bob Thornton. You know, because Billy's got those sad eyes that I think we all fall for. I see Gwyneth as Rosario Dawson because she's feisty and she looks mental. You know, she looks like she could really...
Is she the one from Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Yeah, so Rosario Dawson has been in Sin City, 7 Pounds, yeah. A movie called Trance.
Yes.
Zombieland's Double Tap.
I'm way off.
Yes, she just looks like at any given moment she could completely change personality and throttle you. And I like that about her.
Yes, it's endearing.
Yeah. Now, Wayne Coratti, that's the one that you've got to nail it. You've got to nail it.
Absolutely.
And I want Wayne Coratti to be absolutely despised the second you see him. So, Tom Hiddleston.
I mean, I don't know. He's a good-looking fella.
He's a good... Well, maybe, but you would never get bored of hitting him with a spade, would you?
I've got great news as well. Tom Hiddleston... I've got a video here of Tom Hiddleston playing an acoustic guitar. He very much, I think, could hold up his end of the bargain in terms of country music.
Exactly, yeah, of course.
As soon as you said, Tom Hiddleston is playing an acoustic guitar, a little voice in the back of my head went, oh, of course.
So obviously this idea has got legs. I mean, loads of legs if you include the orphans. So how are we going to pitch this to... We're back in the real world now. How are we going to pitch this to a commissioner? Because I think it's always really good to have a stunt. Like, how are you... If you walk into the boardroom where there's all these commissioners looking at you, you're about to pitch the Gamble Ramble. What is the thing you're going to do to just shock them, to really get them on board immediately? Have you got, like, some kind of stunt you can do?
Well, I mean, you could burst into the room screaming and throw water in their face. And they go, did you not like that? Well, guess what? In the future, there is no water, so you'll be fine.
And if in the future, that would have been a child.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so you think that was bad now? Imagine a little boy in your face. Edit that out. Edit that out. For the love of God, edit that out.
Next, it's time to get all lovey with Lou Sanders as we brainstorm her idea for an opposites attract romance.
Lou, what have you got for us? Tell us
well,
what we're working with.
My title apparently is, the only thing they've got in common is they're both gay.
That's the title, not even the tagline.
Yeah,
that is the title of the film.
Yeah, yeah. You go in strong, let them know from the outset what it's about. Don't waste people's time.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a married couple. You think it's another heteronormative film with a hot man or a hot woman. But wait, plot twist, they're both gay. They help each other get real and set each other up with people becoming best friend wingmans. Yes? Hello?
Ah. But so they don't get along, though. How do they not get along in other ways other than...
Look, what it is, there's a man and a woman. They're together. You think, oh, yeah, we've seen it. Hello? Turns out they're both gay. Mm-hmm. Now... the relationship's falling apart, and then they just basically help each other become the best people that they can be. At the end, right, the woman becomes a human rights lawyer and doesn't settle down, and the gay man, she gives him away. And then, get this, bit of a plot twist coming up. I hope you're sitting down. She gives this lovely couple, this gay men's couple, she gives them her womb to have a baby.
Now, when you say gives them her womb,
I take it inside.
Yeah.
It's still in her.
Well, we can discuss the ins and outs. Is it sci-fi? You know, is it sci-fi and she's taking that womb out? Because she's busy. She doesn't want to... She's a human rights lawyer. She's changing the world, right? Does she want to grow a baby inside her? She ain't got time for the morning sickness. She's got 6 a.m. meetings, you know?
Yep.
So she's a human rights lawyer. So I guess the opposite of a human rights lawyer. Is he, like, really into, like, capital punishment and stuff? Is he, like, really evil?
Yeah, like, you know how... Queen guy.
Freddie Mercury?
Yes. He was married to a girl and he really loved her, but and they were like soulmates, but they weren't romantically very good for each other because, of course, he was gay. And this couple were really close and they love each other, but they both have to then come to terms that they think they might be gay. And she sees him be gay first and she's Devo, and then she realizes she's gay. So it's like an awakening film. It's like a second coming of age.
I think that's a really nice, I like the idea that the opposites attract thing is actually, it's the opposite of opposites attract. It's two similar people who can't, can't be in love. It does go against the title of the film, which is all the only thing they have in common is that they're gay.
Oh yeah. I mean, looking at the title now in the film Black Day, we're all thinking, is there anything in the play on words of bye? Because they're saying bye, but they're also
bye bye baby.
Like goodbye.
Bye bye baby. Because they're both bye and they're having a baby.
Yeah. Well, bye bye baby.
We've got it.
I should check though. Are they bi or are they gay?
Well, they sleep with each other and get off on it. So you tell me.
How do they discover that the other person might be more attracted to the same sex rather than them?
Well, maybe it's they've come across an iCloud folder.
Right.
I think what it should be is that we should meld love.com as a website idea and Bye Bye Baby. And the idea is they're both on this buy website because they're actually looking at other people and they're curious, and then maybe they have gender neutral names and they start chatting each other up. They're like, oh no, I didn't want to attract you because I'm actually looking for someone of the same gender. And they're like, me too. And then they're like, oh, so we can be best friends and also support each other in our romantic endeavors. And then
that's really nice.
The womb thing.
Yeah. that's for the producers to sort out, the womb thing.
Yeah.
So do they fall in love all over again now that they see themselves as the sex they're more attracted to, but then as a mirror to them falling more in love, they also realize more about themselves, which leads to the ending where they're like, yeah, we still love each other totally, but I'm going to have to go over here and do this and take my womb with you.
Yeah.
Although I take my womb with you is weird.
Yeah. Look, hey, don't shoot the messenger.
I think that's great. Lou, did you have any ideas for casting? Anyone that you would like to see in the starring roles here?
No.
Great. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We'll leave it up to the audience's imagination. See you. Night-night.
Yeah. They might do something. I do like Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah.
If you can factor her in.
Yeah. I think she should narrate it. I think there should be a narrator, and we'll have Whoopi Goldberg narrate it. And the very end of it, Whoopi Goldberg she's delivered the baby. It turns out she's the midwife of the baby, and then she's telling the baby about how the parents met.
I thought you were going to say she was the baby, all grown up.
I know. For a second, I thought you're like, she's voicing the baby, like, and look who's talking. Like... How are we going to get their attention, Lou? What stunt are we going to pull to get the execs listening? Just walk in, slap a womb on the table.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, or maybe just, like, threaten them. Sort of pictures of their family and stuff like that and say, we know where you live, and if you don't commission this, you know, you're going to get it, that kind of thing.
It's a bold move. I respect it.
It's such a lovely film about the complex nature of relationships and love. And what it is that brings people together and teaches them to stay and to continue on in life. It's so beautifully written. And then to pitch it by threatening the
smash their house in. Yeah.
Look, it's a tough business, Beck. You've got to work hard to get your film made.
Coming up next is Laura Lex, who came on the pod to discuss her obsession with romantic Christmas films and to pitch this festive masterpiece.
Laura, seeing as you're the biggest number one all-time fan, let's hear it. Do you want to give us a title first, or do you want to tell us what the rough plot is?
Okay, I want to give you an idea of what I wanted to do with this film first.
Oh, okay.
Because
all right.
Okay. Obviously, I do watch a lot of these films, and some of the things I really wanted to bring into this are a real overblown budget on a magical world that even though they've had lots of money, they've not done it very well. So I really want that kind of a sense. I wanted it to be very magical. Like, I didn't want it to be set in normal city or town or world. I was like, it's Christmas. You don't get that much chance to have things set in the North Pole. I want it to be a fully invested Christmas feeling. But I also wanted it to be modern. So I have called my film Christmas Eve and Christmas Steve. So it's set in the North Pole. Okay. Now, in the world of this film, Father Christmas is very much a concept that exists. All right.
Yeah.
So we'd probably set that up, you know, quick montage at the beginning of Earth children believing in Father Christmas, sending off their letters, Father Christmas on billboards, Father Christmas is a thing, right?
Yes.
Then we get to the North Pole, where we discover that while Father Christmas is the brand, there is not one factory at the North Pole full of elves, but two. One factory is run by Christmas Steve. Christmas Steve looks like Father Christmas. He is the patriarchal figure that we all know and love. He is the Christmas card image of Father Christmas, right? Mm. The other factory is run by Christmas Eve, who does just as much work as Christmas Steve, works just as hard, makes the toys, sends them out, is just as magical, is just as brilliant, but is not Father Christmas. The best she's ever done is managed to get her image out there as a sort of Mrs. Christmas figure. This is obviously a bit annoying, but, you know, it's tradition now. They don't want to ruin it for the kids, but it grinds on the workers at Christmas Eve's factory, right? Obviously, patriarchy being what it bees, the Victorians went with Christmas Steve, and that's just the way it is. Okay, now, the Christmas Steve team of elves are kind of getting a bit big-headed about it, right? Like, even though they're both doing equal work, because the Christmas Steve team are the ones, you know, like the front runners, they're getting a bit knob-headed about it. And Christmas Eve is getting kind of annoyed that she doesn't get as much credit, but, you know, she's not that fussed. It's about the children. Her team are incandescent, right? So these two teams of elves in the two factories are just not getting on well at all over this. So a war breaks out between the two factories, right? Now, this is where we meet the head elves of the two different factories. The head of the Christmas Steve team of elves is Nicola Safety. And on her name tag, it would read Elf N Safety.
Oh. I was searching for that.
We
searching
live for, it,
for
right?
what it was going to be.
So Nicola Safety, head elf of the Christmas Steve team, she leads a raid on the Christmas Eve factory, right? What? Oh no, it's sort of hijinksy, but it's real upsetting, and the Christmas Eve team can't stand for this, right? So the head elf of the Christmas Eve team, Imelda Salation, leads a retaliatory raid back. So the war is really escalating between these two teams of elves, right? And Eve and Steve are losing control of their respective camps. And they're sort of increasingly desperate that their teams have really lost sight of what Christmas is for. And they're sort of like, they don't know what to do. And one day they're out wandering, trying to come up with ideas and desperately worrying. And they bump into each other and they get on like a bloody house on fire to Eve and Steve. Yeah. There's real chemistry between these two kids. Now, they agree that the best way to get the factories to finish the presents all on time, because obviously you need the Christmas Eve deadline in a Christmas film, the best way to get it finished on time is to merge the two factories and the two teams. This goes down like a cup of cold sick with the two teams of elves, right? But they agree to get on with it. So they merge the two teams. And this is where we really begin to see the simmering sexual tension between Imelda and Nicola as well. They're sort of like these two really efficient, brilliant elves. They actually really admire and quite love each other too. So there's two love stories in this. Now, it gets to Christmas Eve. The presents are ready to go out. They've managed to make it work between the two crews of elves. But on Christmas Eve, Christmas Steve falls ill. What are they going to do? Father Christmas isn't able to deliver the presents. Now, obviously, Christmas Eve is like, well, I have the same magical powers as him. I guess I could do it. And this causes the Christmas Steve elves to point the blame at Christmas Eve for having poisoned him.
That's not fair.
So that she could go out and deliver the presents and get the glory. Now, a huge row breaks up between the elves, right? Everyone's at each other's throats. All of the goodwill of the last few weeks is all falling apart. But Christmas Eve is like, look, whatever we do when I get back, whatever blame I take, whatever, whatever, I've got to get these presents to the kids, right? So she climbs into the sleigh. But little do we know that Nicholas Safety, the head elf of the Christmas Eve team, has sabotaged the sleigh so
with
that Christmas
name.
Eve will fail. I know, right?
Oh, no.
You'd never see it coming. Wow. And Christmas Steve will never be usurped. Now, when Imelda Salation realises what's happened, she is heartbroken that Nicola Safety would endanger Christmas Eve, would endanger children, would endanger the very message of Christmas. She harnesses the only reindeer left behind, who is a very rude reindeer called Dolph, and she races after Christmas Eve. And she chases the sleigh down. There's a terrifying in-flight rescue mission and repairing of the sleigh, but they make it through and the last present just about gets delivered as the sun rises. And they get home and Christmas Steve is recovering from his absolute non-poisoning. Everybody's realised that something else happened to make him ill. It wasn't Christmas Eve. Nicola Safety is fired and put to work as the worst job that they can think of. And Imelda is sad, but she has plenty of new admirers now because she did the sort of solo rescuing job. And Christmas Eve and Christmas Steve get married and they agree to alternate on present delivering. And there's just a much more gender-equal future for the Christmas story.
Yay! I mean, it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, but that's not the question here.
It absolutely would pass the Bechdel test, though.
What, that it takes them getting married to work out how to share Christmas?
Oh, yeah, but the two head elves, like the three of the four main characters
that's
are
true.
All women, and the head elves would be discussing presents and all sorts. The Bechdel test,
that's
yeah,
true. There's
totally
a lot of,
that.
Like, admin chat that's happening at the factory that I forgot about.
There's a lot of admin back.
I've got a couple of questions. One major one. In, like, Christmas films, I mean, only one. In Christmas films, sometimes, like, Santa is portrayed as this kind of immortal being, right, who's just been around for, like, hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case with these two? Steve,
yes, I think so. But what I've done is I've gone for a sort of middle-aged actor, and then I would want him to be aged up. I'd want it to look very stereotypically Christmas. That would be important.
Okay, because you're going like stereotypical Christmas. Yeah.
So the look is very stereotypical, but the plot is like, here's all the stuff behind the branding.
To me, that sounds like your ideal actor would be Dean Cain, King of the Christmas films.
Do you know what, babe? I've not gone the one I've put down on my notes, I've gone for James Marsden.
Ooh,
yeah.
Who I think is a cracking comedy actor. He's very, very, very funny. He's got very twinkly blue eyes.
Oh, yeah.
I can really imagine James Marsden being a Father Christmas or a Christmas Steve.
Yeah, that's a great show.
Yeah. Yeah, he would.
Co-star of Sonic the Hedgehog, of course.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, was the last film I saw in the cinema before the lockdown. All the cinemas closed after this due to losing money, that's going to be the last film I ever saw in a cinema.
What a legacy.
Who else do you see playing the other characters then?
Okay, so James Marsden is my big ticket actor, probably. As Christmas Eve, I've gone for a lesser known actress, but someone that I think is a phenomenal actress and I wish she was in more stuff. I've gone for Jenna Fischer, who plays Pam in The Office, the American
Office. Yeah, who's also in Blades of Glory.
Yes, I think she's brilliant and I don't think she's done enough for my liking. So I've got her in as Christmas Eve.
Nice.
Playing Nicola Safety, I've gone for Catherine Hahn, who is just a brilliant comedy actress. And then playing...
What would I have seen Catherine in? I'm not sure who Catherine Hahn is.
She's in Bad Mums 2016, Bad Mums Christmas 2017.
I love Catherine
Hahn.
I've just realised She's in Parks and Rec as the sassy yes. PR lady.
She's excellent. I would definitely want her. And then as Imelda Salation playing the other, like, brilliant together head elf, I want Sandra Oh.
Oh, yeah.
So that was my casting criteria for those four.
We'll be away for a bit, but we're still on social media everywhere, so don't forget to give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by searching for You Watched Pod. Drop us a message, leave a comment, send a tweet, let us know what you think of the series, and you'll make Beck very happy. That's right, it's Beck Hill, not producer Rory, that needs a confidence boost. Who was it who told you that? Next, we have radical dude Matt Hyten taking us back in time, sort of, with his take for an idea for a nostalgic 90s film.
Matt, what have you got for us to introduce to the nostalgic 90s category?
I think you're gonna love this. From the title alone, I think you'll know what this film is. It's called Prom Hack.
Prom Hack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You get the vibe already. Do you want to hear the blurb?
Of course.
Strap in. Okay. When a meteor destroys the school the night before prom, it's up to a group of nerds to hack into their classmates' home computers to let them know that prom will happen. Oh, yeah. But what do computer nerds know about putting together prom? Can they avoid Chris Christopher, a jock whose dad manages all the bands in town, get enough liquor to spice up and make prom cool, and get prom dates? And let's not even get into TJ, the alien who crash-landed with the meteor, and is all about getting rad. So that's pretty much it.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. You've just thrown it all at the fan, and it's there.
TJ must have a celebrity voice, right?
Oh, yeah. I keep bouncing around with who TJ would be. So
would TJ I think TJ should be a puppet, like one of those alien puppets.
Yeah, nice. Definitely. Yeah, like Mac and Me style alien.
Mm. Yeah.
But I either think it's... So I narrowed it down to either Jim Carrey or Robin Williams was who was really owning this for me. Because like everyone thinks TJ is human. Like they've done that sort of... He's my cousin from out of town. But he's clearly an alien in a backwards cap and a flannel shirt. It's California Man. He's going to make the nerds cool.
Yeah.
Even though the nerds have no cred. And like when TJ gets scared, he goes, "A wuzzle!" And everyone starts saying it. Like that's their thing. Like, "Hey, a wuzzle, TJ." It's great.
Nice.
I get the feeling that all of the town's girls are like really attracted to their cousin from out of town. They're attracted to TJ, and then TJ's
going
to try and offload all of the women onto his nerd friends.
Yeah, there's a scene where he accidentally goes on a date, and one of the girls is trying to kiss him, but he's just trying to eat human food, and hilarious consequences.
And I assume his mouth would be like in his bum or something, and it's all like, oh.
Yeah. Slow down, TJ.
He actually poops through his face, and so when she tries to kiss
Jesus.
Him, he's like,
face back? You didn't even say a hole, just out of his face. Oh.
There's a scene at prom where everyone's around and going, chug, 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 and it's absolutely disgusting.
Oh. Maybe he sleeps with one of the school kids' mums as well. You know, there's always that
scene. This is my thought. I basically wanted the classic, everyone fancies one of the mums. Mm. And I thought it'd be great to put something like Jennifer Aniston as the mum, but then her daughter, who's the sister to one of the nerds, is played by Courtney Cox. So like it's just really annoying that everyone knows them from Friends by this point. It's a mum-daughter thing.
Yeah.
Is Courtney Cox just an old sister, or is she?
They've just given her a side ponytail to look young.
So you've already cast them. Did you think of casting for the others?
Yes. Yeah, so there's three nerds. Jim Johnson, who would be the main nerd, who's not quite a nerd, but He's a nerd. Mm. And nerd is said a lot in this film. Yeah. I thought Elijah Wood would be Jim Johnson.
Mm, great.
Oh, nice.
Who are the other nerds?
So there's two friends. I think Kenan Thompson would be one of the best friends.
Amazing. Jim Johnson and Kenan Thompson.
Yeah. He keeps his real name just for that. And then I just wanted to get Ben Savage in from Boy Meets World.
Oh,
he's called Randy Pants Down Fitzpatrick because one time when he nearly kissed a girl, the jock Chris Christopher pulled his pants down, so now everyone calls him Pants Down. But that's going to really play off at prom when it flies back on him. So yeah.
Yes, Ben Savage is from Boy Meets World, Girl Meets World, Girl Meets Boy. They really strung this out, didn't they? And Criminal Minds.
Yeah, which is also in the Meets World series.
Yes, exactly. It's a spin-off.
I did have a side plot with the cheerleaders. The nerds obviously need prom dates, and in the end they'll be with the cheerleaders. But there's a big subplot that's going on where the cheerleaders have accidentally woken up an ancient witch. So they're dealing with that for a lot of the film, and I'm not sure how to reconcile the plots, but I know at the end the witch leaves for the big city on a bus, and as the just before the doors close, she looks to the cheerleaders and goes, "In many ways, you're like the coven I wish I had." And then she goes off to New York.
Going to New York is so 90s.
Yeah, exactly. It's very clever.
How does the nerds one finish then? Is that I'm guessing that they all get crowned prom king on the internet or whatever.
Wow.
However they've hacked it.
Things heat up with Chris Christopher. He's been a real nuisance throughout the film, really thwarting them at every step. So what happens is they fall out, obviously, because it doesn't look like prom's going to happen. And Chris Christopher comes causing trouble. And what they do, because they're hacker nerds, they manage to trick him and put him in a VR helmet that he doesn't realize he's in. And he thinks he's making out with Jennifer Aniston. But what's really happening is he's making out with Kenan Thompson's dog. And they're live streaming this on internet cameras, which are new in the 90s.
Yeah.
And everyone comes together and says, you know what? This is the last time we're all going to be together before we go off to university, guys. We're going to make prom happen. So the nerds meet up where prom should have happened but failed, and the whole school's come together to make it happen. And even though Chris Christopher tried to make his dad, who, if you remember, is in charge of all bands in the town, he says, there'll be no music here, but no doubt turn up and play anyway. So
oh, nice. Wow. What he needs to say, like, I've no doubt there'll be a band playing.
Oh yeah, they keep seeding it too much throughout the film. Yes.
I think they keep seeding no doubt, but then Hole ends up playing.
Oh my god, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, and the dad of the baddie turns to the camera and said, "I told you there'd be no doubt."
Matt. You've got a good imagination.
Yeah.
I want to know how you're going to get the interest of the big movie execs here.
First of all, I'm going to make it look like a meteor's crashed into every American high school with a little...
Every?
Yeah, so it's actually a mechanical egg.
The paper mache?
Yeah. It's a mechanical paper mache egg. And if I've timed it right, when everyone shows up to school and's like, what's happened? There's a meteor. A little puppet of TJ opens up and TJ's there and he goes, a rizzle! And then he invites everyone to the premiere.
I think we don't even get commissioners to come to us. I think we get the audience who are net savvy web hackers, and then they just hack into banks and take all the money for us so that we can make the film.
Yeah. Exactly.
I love it.
We don't have a production office. We just have a series of Java cafes around the country.
It's a movie for hackers, funded by hackers, funded by everyone else.
Yeah.
Next is closet Star Trek fan Jessica Fosterque and her pitch for an exciting space travel TV show.
Right, Jessica, let's get your pitch. Exciting space travel, what have you got?
Okay, so this is a show called Planet Whack, Space Cuddle, 8 million.
Oh, I'm already in.
I love this already.
And obviously it's this TV space adventure series, so it's where a load of sexy astronauts live in space on a massive ship where they've got holograms and, like, impossibly well-equipped, both intellectually and physically, doctors, as well as all the usual captains and engineers and futuristic technology, and probably, like, some improbably lush gardens on the ship, even though there is.
Oh, yeah.
So here's what happens, or here's, like, the bulk of it. Okay, so Space Cuddle 8 million is a massive starship. It's designed to be like a mediatory vessel sent to resolve any conflict going on in space, right? And obviously there's always loads going on because it's space and everyone's really moody. And they get a distress signal from a dwarf planet, like think of like Isle of Wight, but in space, real small. and they get there and it turns out the distress is because that the aliens that live on this planet are sick of their own children. So first sort of third of the show is taken up with them like trying to work out why, and they realize that the children are geniuses, and weirdly, like, so, like, there's something special about caterpillars on the planet as well, and they try everything they can to try and sort the conflict out, but they can't, and the people on the planet are like, these children aren't geniuses, they're nightmare, and they sort of disagree. They can see that these kids have got incredible talent, so they take the children, and for a laugh they take the caterpillars as well away up onto their ship, but when then they find out when they employ them on the ship, because everyone starts falling out and stuff on the ship, and at first you think, oh, these kids are really creepy and they're making everybody fall out and stuff, but as it turned time turns on, they find out that the children actually are like whistleblowers, because what, these genius weird, they are weird, the children, and then some of them will be annoying. Let's not take them so that they're completely different to children as we know it. Let's make them pretty annoying, especially when they're singing all together. And then
sticky fingers,
just the sound of it. There's so many adverts on at the moment to cheer everyone up with the sound of children singing. It's such a horrid noise, actually, if it's not your kid, isn't it? The sound of a child singing. So let's make these annoying kids sing all the time. And anyway, they realise that they're not evil. They're actually whistleblowers. What the kids have found out is that all the people working on To Cuddle 8 Million have been having their food and drink spiked with mood suppressant drugs by some kind of overlord federation. And that was the only reason why everybody on board had ever been so cuddly. And now, because these kids had worked this out, and as part of the experiment of working it out, had reduced the drugs that people were taking, this wasn't people like falling out with each other and stuff because something negative had happened. It was just them being their real selves and all having to face their own emotions. They sort of have to come to terms with whether they could still be a little bit cuddly at least, and how much of reality they can bear to live in. And obviously, like, a long way, I want to meet loads of cool space animals and like hurt each other loads and fall in love loads and do all that stuff as well.
I love it.
I mean, what I've done here is rolled with like exactly the sort of sci-fi TV space adventure romp that I like, which is one that's actually just a really fiercely messy drama, but just set in space in nice, in lovely outfits.
The Space Cuddle 8 million.
Yeah.
They are drugged in this way, presumably as a way to make them more kind of friendly or whatever for their kind of, you know, intermediary activities.
Exactly.
So they're kind of very personable and very nice. So they're kind of drugged in this way to be very cuddly and very happy.
Yeah.
So presumably the kids managed to disrupt this in some way. So then there's a lot of conflict in the show, it sounds like, of... Yeah, the crew of Space Cuddle 8 Million kind of still trying to basically learn to empathize genuinely with the kind of needs of the people that they meet, because now they don't have the drugs doing it for them.
Yeah.
There's kind of, they need to kind of grow as actual people and do it for real this time.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Mm.
And they won't all manage.
Yeah. And they go out the airlock.
Yeah.
And what about the caterpillars?
Oh, well. I don't want to skip too far. I mean, basically... Do you want to know the big ending?
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Because I think, like, once they've got on there, it's like, well, you know, we obviously, everyone's going to make sure the caterpillars are all right and everything. But the big ending will be that they, like, actually, they're going to find their own facing their own emotions pretty unbearable. It's certainly the people in leadership on the ship. So they do plan to get rid of the children, and in quite a sort of a bad, murdery way. But at the last minute, they realise what a favour they've been done, and ask these kids to stay, but they'd forgotten about the caterpillars who secretly revolted. And just as they're all about to make friends, the caterpillars eat them all up and take over the ship.
Yes. Because actually a huge group of caterpillars would be terrifying with those little hairy legs crawling around. Are they human-sized caterpillars or actual caterpillar-sized caterpillars?
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe they have the power to become human-sized because I think they'd have to do the full takeover. Or it'd be quite... I wonder if it'd be, like, grosser and more interesting to watch if they're tiny, but they're, like, other creatures that are small but can eat things. I just skipped at my own idea. My whole back was shattered. But they can, like a snake, they can eat things that are way bigger than them. So you get to watch a tiny caterpillar devour a human.
And they probably love it on your spaceship because you've got amazing gardens on there. So the caterpillars just like multiply and multiply.
I'd like all the characters on board to be named after objects.
Yes.
So the captain is called Tarpaulin.
That's good.
I want that to be played by someone super hot.
That's a great name.
Yeah, like that's going to be Thandie Newton or Christina Hendricks.
Yes.
The leader of the children is just called Trouser. The ship's council is called French Horn. The onboard chef is called Spork. There's a joyfully promiscuous one called Showerhead, who Captain Tarpaulin falls in love with. And then there could just be one called Snood that nobody likes.
Not Snood.
We always try and have an interesting way of pitching the show to executives and everything. Do you have a stunt that we could do?
Pop a bit of drugs in their coffee around the pitching table. Watch them start, I mean... Just sort of like leaning in towards each other a bit more, probably touching their hair a bit more. What I thought.
It would be really creepy to have a load of kids just like come in and hug them as well, wouldn't it? Loads of really friendly children. Creepy. Like loads of them just appearing from everywhere.
Can they sing the theme tune as well?
Mm.
Yeah. So annoying.
Planet Whack, cuddle 8 million, going around. Solving problems. I mean, I was waiting for everyone else to join in.
You're doing such a joyful job. We loved it.
It's kind of haunting, and I like it that there's just a single lone, kind of half committed voice singing the theme tune. And finally, let's hear from Emily Lloyd-Sayani, one half of comedy duo Egg, for her idea for a mind-bending movie.
All right, Emily, I'm excited and waiting and ready. I want to hear your mind-bending pitch.
Okay. Well, the thing is with mind-bending films, they have to be quite high concept. Mm. And I think that was a really unfair ask of someone like me. Okay, I'm 9 months pregnant. And I found my keys in the fridge this morning. So its working title is Maya's Ruin. Ooh. And the genre I've kind of gone for is a dark teenage drama.
Mm. Nice. Okay.
So character A, Maya, is going to uni this fall, right?
Yeah.
So she sets off on a summer adventure to South America. So she's traveling solo, which is a big adventure for her. Mm. She's a real family gal. And she meets a girl on her first night, character B, Arlene.
Yes.
But she's doing the same thing and she's traveling alone. And they become just thick as thieves and they decide to stick together on this journey. And Maya had planned to go to Bolivia to the salt flats, but Arlene is going to a place that she's never heard of, Nicolombia, which sounds really weird, like no rules apply there, really bohemian. And she thinks, you know, caution to the wind, I'm on my travels, I'm going with her. And all seems really normal at this point. There's just really great montages because it's quite a long journey to Colombia from where
Emily
they are.
Emily loves a montage. She lives for a montage.
How many minutes of the runtime are we accounting for with a montage?
Probably Stephen? 45.
Oh, good. That'll help us get over the 90-minute line.
It's a really three-hour film. So, you can show me the worst film ever. If it's got a good montage in, I'll be like, redeemed, fine. So they get to this weird village And people keep recognizing or thinking they recognize Maya, you know, as character Ray, but they keep calling her Amber. Ooh. But then some of them are quite happy to see her. Some of them are very surprised to see her. Some people are a bit shifty, but she's like, hey, what a weird, fun bohemian place. And they laugh it off and they get free drinks wherever they go because they're like, oh, I thought you were Amber. And then it's a bit of a wild night and they get back and their hostel has been robbed. Now, Maya wakes up the next morning and Arlene has gone.
Oh.
It seems like she's continued her travels without her or she's just freaked out. We don't know what's happened to Arlene, but she's just gone. She's not worried about her because it's not Arlene's story. And she realises that her passport have gone and her money's gone and she's trapped here. So she goes to the locals for kind of help, but no one seems to believe her. And everyone is like, oh, it is you, Amber, telling that story again.
Oh.
Twist.
And so she's intrigued by the confusion and seeing no other options. She thinks, well, maybe I will pretend to be this Amber. People seem to like her. She seems to know people. And maybe I can find out who she is and try and find the real person. But it backfires when the only people that will take her in and help her seem to know Amber very well. And it turns out Amber was part of an occult-like underworld where everyone wore sunglasses and leather.
I don't like it. My mind is already getting ready to be bent.
And they reveal to her that Amber will have to be killed for Maya to get her life back. And she's like, I'm sorry, you say what? And we're watching it and we're like, what?
Yeah.
Sorry, what an incredible twist.
Oh yeah,
we're
watching it all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
watching
she
the
gets
hell out of it.
Very deep. She's trained, because Amber's left this kind of weird cult, underworld cult, she's in trouble. So they train Maya up to assassinate Amber so she can have a life back. It's like, you help us, we'll help you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she's like, whoa, no, I'm just a girl on my gap year. But she's enthralled by the fact that magic does exist because she's from our world, right? And she has access to it. And then she sees a social media pic of Arlene heading down to Bolivia and she's in the picture. As in like her, Maya.
Amber is.
Amber is in the picture.
Oh. Maya.
So she goes on a mission to kill Amber. And we get some lovely cinematography, by the way, because South America is so beautiful.
Oh, I can just imagine it.
In doing so, she gets more and more addicted to her kind of powers that she's been taught, more unlikable, more bitter, more powerful. And we wonder, was she Amber all along?
Oh, because she takes to it so well.
She takes to it so well and she gets there and there's this innocent girl being like, please don't kill me. I'm doing uni this fall.
I'm the real Maya. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I know nothing about this cult. I've never heard of Nicolumbia before.
Exactly. Exactly. That is my pitch.
Oh, my goodness.
So is Arlene in on this? Is this a kind of thing where Arlene is like...
That's exactly what I was thinking.
At the behest of Amber is like drawing this person in to replace her? Or is it... Or she's an innocent person. It depends on whether Maya is Amber or Amber is Maya.
And then what happens is, at the end, she does kill Amber and skins her alive and realises, oh, it's not me. We've got completely different skeletons.
We were just skin twins, but not actual...
Oh, no, I've made a huge mistake. Oh, well, off to uni. I think it's got to be that... Arlene especially questions that some things don't add up. Some things aren't quite the same.
And there'll be one of those, you know, those classic setups at the beginning where she's like, hey, do you want some hot sauce with your breakfast burrito? Oh no, I hate hot sauce.
I'm allergic to hot sauce probably.
Yeah. And then in the second one, she'll be like, hey, can you pass me the Cholula? And then Arlene's like, bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, and then Hans Zimmer comes in with a really, really slow rendition of Jolene, but it's been changed to Arlene. And then
we saved the film. What kind of magic would it be? That's what I'm interested in. I'm thinking, what would be the flavour? Would it be a kind of Mayan, ancient Mayan sacrificey kind of, on one of those Mayan temples, you know?
Mayan is very... blood-oriented magic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's got to be pretty dark for the mind-bending.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Can one of the other twists be that they keep talking about the magic and it's all very scary and dark and leathery and, you know, what's going on? But when it actually comes time to her using the magic, it's just like pulling a hanky out of her sleeve that like keeps changing colours.
She
like makes rings join
she,
up.
She puts a foam ball under a cup and then sacrifices a sheep and then lifts the cup up and the foam ball is gone.
But it's all played completely straight.
Yeah, because like a dramatic thump when she lifts it up and it's gone.
And no one in the film will question it or even raise an eyebrow. It's all very serious. I think that is part of mind-bending films, though, because you could be like, part of the mind-bend could be, what genre is this fucking film I'm watching?
This is a David Blaine best of. What's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of David Blaine.
He's going to have a cameo.
Just hanging in a box.
Yeah, you know, he never comes out. There's just a box in the film that has David Blaine in it. But he never comes out, which
They're
is another twist.
They're all just
twist.
Taking shots off it. Hey, Amber, have another
so he's
shot.
Like, he's actually listed in the credits, like at the beginning of the film with all the big stars.
But it's okay, because after the film, you would read that in a BuzzFeed article and you'd be like, oh, wow.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh my
10
God.
Things you didn't notice in my
room. I can see the thumbnail now with like a circled bush in the background. 10 things you missed.
100%. And every single one of them is really far in the distance. David.
Yes. This episode of Because You Watched featured Beck Hill, Michael Legg, Lou Sanders, Laura Lex, Matt Hyten, Jessica Fostercue, Egg, aka Emily Lloyd Sayani and Anna Long Brophy, Georgia Maguire, John Gracie, Paul Foxcroft, and me, Rory Binks. It was produced by Joe Grace and Martin Trickey.